Hey everybody, what's going on? This is Ryan. Welcome to episode 6 of the Radio Live Transmission Podcast. Thank you for listening. Today I'm going to be giving you reviews of new releases from the Mountain Goats, At the Drive-In, and the Afghan Whigs. And then on the main event portion of the podcast, myself and a special guest will be reviewing the new album from Feist, that's F-E-I-S-T, Leslie Feist, the new album Pleasure that she released at the end of April. So that's coming up in the main event. Before I get to today's brief reviews, I'd just like to say a few words about Chris Cornell. You know, obviously, the entire music world was, you know, shocked and saddened, you know, by his death. And Chris Cornell was a very important artist for me, both as a teenager and throughout my adult life. So I'd just like to say a few words about him. This won't be too long, but I feel like I owe it to him. So to me, Chris Cornell was a hero. When I was entering my teenage years, my older sister Carrie and some of my friends from school introduced me to bands like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Stone Temple Pilots. My cousin Matt, who was the same age as my sister, introduced me to bands like Pantera and expanded my knowledge of Metallica far past the recently released Black Album. All the while, my parents filled our house with the sounds of The Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, The Doors, and various other legendary artists of the 1960s and 70s. Unlike these artists, Chris Cornell, via the band Soundgarden, was not presented to me by a family member or friend, and therefore I felt that I could have a special private connection with this amazing band whose sound seemed impossible to pin down. I'm unsure of the exact date of my first exposure to the song Jesus Christ Pose, but I know that it changed my life forever. Everything about the song seemed disturbing to me, not least the howling vocals of Cornell. I had never heard a human being sing like that. It sounded like someone crying out in pain, while at the same time conveying a vague sense of hostility or apprehension. Children who are raised in Christian households tend to pay attention to lyrics that mention Christ, and while my parents were by no means overbearing in their beliefs or attitudes, they may have questioned my musical choices a bit had they heard this song. I was smart enough not to play it loud enough for them to hear. My young mind devoured the Bad Motorfinger album and subsequently the Super Unknown album. I believe that my affinity for musical evolution and albums of transition can be pinpointed to this time when I found out just how much artists can change and grow over a span of a couple of years. I felt slightly perturbed that the video for Black Hole Sun was all over MTV and my special connection with Soundgarden seemed to be slipping out of reach. I was glad that my friends were finding out about the band, don't get me wrong. However, that feeling of secret kinship with Cornell and Company instilled in me a deep emotional connection that continues to this day. It was also at this time that I listened to Cornell's first solo album called Euphoria Morning and ate it up like candy. It felt like having a private conversation with him, and although I didn't listen to much of his subsequent solo material, Euphoria Morning will always have a special place in my heart. When the follow-up to Super Unknown was released, an album called Down on the Upside, some of my prior excitement over Soundgarden had dissipated. I was discovering so many bands and so many different genres of music that it was tough to focus on the band as I had before. Over the years, I've come to appreciate the album much more, even though it will never quite equal Super Unknown. Then the unthinkable happened. Soundgarden disbanded. Coincidentally, a few years after Soundgarden broke up, another one of my favorite bands, Rage Against the Machine, broke up. And my disappointment was only tempered by the scores of other bands whose catalogs I was diving into at the time. When I found out that Chris Cornell had joined forces with Tom Morello, Brad Wilk, and Tim Comerford of Rage, I had to pinch myself. I was too young to realize the prevalence of so-called supergroups in rock and roll, bands like the Yardbirds, Cream, and even Journey. This felt like something extraordinarily fresh to me. I was nervous, but immensely excited. Audioslave's self-titled debut was, in my opinion, a mixed bag. Songs like Show Me How to Live, Like a Stone, and I Am the Highway connect with me profoundly to this day. But some of the songs felt like shaky bridges between Soundgarden and Rage, not surprisingly. The band refined their sound over the course of their next two records, and although I wasn't all that interested in the material, I was happy that Cornell and Morello and company were still making music. Audioslave eventually disbanded, and though Soundgarden did reunite to release a decent album called King Animal and tour sporadically, they never seemed to recapture that spirit that grabbed hold of me at an impressionable young age and shook the hell out of me. The one constant through all those years was Cornell's voice. It was incredibly powerful, with a range that made me raise my eyebrows in disbelief. Many of Cornell's lyrics may have been cryptic and poetic, but when he sang those lyrics, his entire being was behind it, and in his prime, no other vocalist could even come close. At a time when I'm still lamenting the loss of figures like Leonard Cohen, David Bowie, and Prince, losing another megalithic figure of the music world, especially one I spent so many of my formative years listening to, is a crushing blow. Much like with Bowie, I had this sort of juvenile naivety about Cornell, expecting him to live forever. You want your heroes to be immortal, and when they die, a strange thing occurs. A piece of your connection with that artist is enshrined in your memory, protected against the pain of the physical loss of your champion. Chris Cornell lives on, in a sense, because I can always seek out his voice. Many called him the voice of a generation after his death, and while I agree wholeheartedly with that sentiment, it's more than that for me in the end. Chris Cornell's voice is the voice of my adolescence, a voice of myriad emotion, capturing and preserving my memories of that stage of my life in profoundly bittersweet ways. In thinking about this segment, I spent quite a bit of time trying to pick the most appropriate quotation from Cornell's catalog of lyrics, but in the end, I decided on a set of lyrics that have haunted me since I first heard them and which can be interpreted many different ways. They are, on a cobweb afternoon, in a room full of emptiness, by a freeway, I confess I was lost in the pages of a book full of death, reading how we'll die alone, and if we're good, we're laid to rest, anywhere we want to go. That's from the Audioslave song, Like a Stone, from their self-titled debut album. So rest in peace, Chris. I know where to find you when I need you. All right, so why don't we get into today's reviews? First review is for the new album from the band The Mountain Goats, an album called Goths, as in G-O-T-H-S, Goths. It was released on May 19th through Merge Records. It's The Mountain Goats' 16th studio album. It was produced by Brandon Eggleston and Scott Sodder, and it received a Metacritic score of 82 out of 100, which is considered universal acclaim on the Metacritic scale, and that was computed out of 18 reviews. An album without guitars seems like an incredible risk for an artist like John Darnielle, who, as the creative force behind the Mountain Goats, has built a musical career out of little more than an acoustic guitar, his voice, and the splendor of lo-fi recording. Somehow, Goths succeeds in the face of this wealth of folk material, and hits far more than it misses. This is a testament to Darnielle's talent as both songwriter and lyricist. The musical backdrops on Goths evoke both the melodramatic nature of the group the album takes its name from, as on the opening track Rain in Soho, and the ennui of a mundane suburban existence in the 1980s on tracks like We Do It Different on the West Coast. Lyrically, the album is rich with reference, creating a collage of images from the post-punk musical landscape of the late 70s and 80s, name-dropping groups like Susie and the Banshees, The Cure, and even Trent Reznor at one point. The track Andrew Eldritch is Moving Back to Leeds tells a story of the Sisters of Mercy frontman returning to his hometown, unable to penetrate the so-called membrane of the outside world, as Darnielle puts it. Darnielle is incredibly clever and thorough with his lyrics, and for me, Goths creates a general image of a teenager dressed all in black, struggling with his or her own boredom on a hot day in suburban Southern California. Now, is Goths a perfect album? I don't think so, but it's close to one. After Rain in Soho, the tempo of the songs doesn't change drastically through to the end of the record. It picks up a bit on the track Unicorn Tolerance, slows down a bit on the track Rage of Travers, but it generally stays, you know, within the parameters that were established by Darnielle's vision in the first song. The highlight of the album is the imagery within the lyrics, however, and this imagery is vivid enough to hold the attention of a listener who cares enough to pay attention to it. So I gave The album Gods, a rating of 8.5 out of 10. And for suggested listening, I should check out the tracks Rain in Soho and the track Stench of the Unburied. All right, so the next review I'm going to do today is for the new At the Drive-In album, which is called Inter Alia, I believe. It's either Inter Alia or Inter Alia. It's, you know, in typical At the Drive-In fashion, it's very sort of cryptic and hard to understand. But anyway, it was released on May 5th through Rise Records. It's their fourth studio album. And it was produced by Rich Costi and Omar Rodriguez Lopez, who, of course, is of At the Drive-In and the Mars Volta, and like I've said before, a million solo records. Inter Alia received a Metacritic score of 70 out of 100, which is considered generally favorable, and that was computed out of 26 reviews. So, after a 17-year hiatus from recording, At the Drive-In returns with Inter Alia. As one would expect, since the newly reformed band is missing founding member Jim Ward, and the remaining members have spent significant runs in the Mars Volta, that being Cedric Pixler-Zavala and Omar Rodriguez Lopez, and also the band Sparta, which would be the guitarists Keely Davis and Paul Hinojos, and drummer Tony Hajar, Inter Alia as a record is by no means a linear sequel to 2000's album Relationship of Command. That may be disappointing to some listeners, as evidenced by the somewhat polarized reaction among critics. As for this listener, it really came as no surprise that this iteration of At the Drive-In sounds largely like a more energetic version of the Mars Volta, just with less noise and prog and more forward momentum. After all, Pixler-Zavala and Rodriguez Lopez are the creative nucleus of both bands, now more than ever with the absence of Ward. The spirit of Relationship of Command era 8 At the Drive-In is present on the album, especially on tracks like Call Broken Arrow and Hostage Stamps. On other tracks, the influence of the Mars Volta comes through more, like the track Continuum or the track Tilting at the Univender. The slow atmospheric creep of Ghost Tape Number 9 is about as experimental as this record gets, and its relevance is, it's up for debate, I'd say. I'm sort of indifferent to it. The rest of the tracks on the album fall somewhere on the spectrum between these two iterations of Pixler-Zavala and Rodriguez Lopez. The track Governed by Contagions has At the Drive-In rhythms tempered by a Pixler-Zavala whose voice, now 17 years older, doesn't have as much bite as it once did, though he is no less a wordsmith. Evidence of this proficiency with words can be found all over the record, and Hostage Stamps is a perfect example. The chorus reads, 30 days spent in the hole, raise yourself a kniving pole, inoculated at the liquor store, drunk on the piss of semaphore embers. Those four lines are so loaded with reference, it's ridiculous. But so Pixler-Zavala can't avoid aging, nor can the rest of the band, so expecting Inter Alia to sound like previous At the Drive-In records is counterproductive. If a listener can appreciate this record for what it is, he or she should find a lot to like here. So I gave Inter Alia a rating of 7.5 out of 10. And for suggested listening, you should check out the tracks Governed by Contagions and Hostage Stamps. All right, so the last brief review that I'm going to do today, and the album that I chose as my personal pick for this episode, is the album In Spades by the band The Afghan Whigs. It was released on May 5th through Sub Pop Records. It's the eighth studio album from the Afghan Whigs. It was produced by Greg Dooley, who is the creative force behind the Afghan Whigs. And it received a Metacritic score of 80 out of 100, which is considered generally favorable. And that was computed out of 23 ratings. So for a guy that's been haunting the alternative music scene since the 1980s, Greg Dooley still sounds pretty fresh. At a time when bands like the Jesus and Mary Chain are releasing tired-sounding albums full of unused or rehashed material, Dooley has crafted an album that delivers on all fronts, even if his age does show at times. Ironically, while the album Goths from the Mountain Goats, which I just reviewed, paints a picture of teenage suburban monotony, In Spades is an album that sounds more like a middle-aged person spending a night reliving his youth. This album's strength lies in its diversity. From the ghostly opener Birdland to the beat-driven Arabian Heights to the mid-tempo alternative rock of Demon in Profile, this record quickly establishes itself as a winding journey through Dooley's musical and lyrical imagination. Speaking of lyrics, Dooley paints pictures that lead this listener to believe that he is still ready for anything at the stroke of midnight. A spooky atmosphere hangs over songs like Oriole, Light as a Feather, and the album's closer, Into the Floor. None of the songs overstay their welcome. Dooley as editor and arranger is like a master filmmaker. Occasionally, Dooley's vocals are pushed to the background. Evidence of this can be found on Arabian Heights and also the track Toy Automatic. For the most part, however, Dooley's vocals and the various musical landscapes strike a good balance and play off of each other well. Dooley is also still capable of bringing things to an appropriate crescendo, as anyone who listens to the album in one sitting will hear after the last notes of Into the Floor fade out. All in all, the Afghan Whigs still have plenty of gas in the tank, which is rare for a band this far into their career. Here's to hoping they continue to make impressive records. So I gave In Spades a rating of 8.5 out of 10. And for suggested tracks, you should check out the track Demon in Profile and the track Oriole. All right, without any further ado, let's get to the main event. Welcome to the main event section of today's episode. We're going to be talking about the new album from Feist entitled Pleasure. The album was released on April 28th through Universal Records. It was co-produced by Feist, Maki, who has worked with Feist before, and a gentleman by the name of Renaud Letang. I'm sure I'm mangling that name, but those are the co-producers. This is Feist's fifth studio album. It's her first new material, her first new album since 2011's album Metals. And Pleasure received a Metacritic score of 80 out of 100, which is considered generally favorable on the Metacritic scale, and that was based on 27 reviews. So today I have the pleasure of... yeah, that was pretty corny. Pleasure of having an old friend of mine on the podcast by the name of Veronica. What's up, Veronica?
Not much. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing just great. How are you, by the way? Good?
I'm very good. Good. Thank you.
Good. Thanks. Why don't you just tell the listeners a little bit about, your musical taste and, your palette, if you will, I guess.
Sure. So I guess I always start out first by saying what I don't listen to. What I don't listen
to
is what I don't listen to is jazz and country. I enjoy everything from industrial rock to new age electronic music to singer-songwriter music. And of course, I have a soft spot for the female vocalist. I used to DJ a show called Pleasurekins. I did not name it. that I inherited it. It was amazing. But we basically just highlighted female musicians, which was super fun, and I did that for about 5 or 6 years.
That's cool. I definitely feel like that's something that's I think it's needed, that type of that show. I think that a lot of the female artists sort of either go ignored or are underappreciated. A lot of genres of music, especially ones that were more sort of male centric, if you will. Genres like metal and stuff like that, so that's pretty cool. But all right, great. Well, I'm sure you guys, did you ever talk about Feist on that show? Do you remember?
Yeah. I'm like trying to think back whether or not there was an overlap. I think that she came out with her first album just as our show ended.
Oh, okay.
So, that was a long time ago.
I got you.
But I remember really enjoying her first album. Yeah, but no, I wasn't DJing anymore.
Okay.
But I definitely would have played some of her lesser played tracks. mm-hmm. on that album.
Cool. Yeah, that's too bad that I didn't, that there was no overlap there.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, why don't you give us a sort of a general impression, you know, of this new record, Pleasure. You know, you can talk about, you know, both likes and dislikes, and then after that, we can talk about highlights of the record.
Sure. I was really enjoying several songs on this album. I think that she gives the impression of being very intimate without being overly confessional, which mm-hmm. I think many singer-songwriters are often branded as, oh, this confessional music, especially when it comes to female singer-songwriters. Mm-hmm. I really loved that she had that she took what she had started exploring on Metals a mm-hmm. little further. I think that she added more of this touch of really gritty rock and roll on some of the songs, which mm-hmm. I loved. But I didn't really like some of the ones that had a little touch of jazz, but that's because I don't listen to jazz. So if you're listening to this and you like jazz, well,
Feist then... couldn't even convert you, I guess.
So. Nope, it's not happening. So
yeah, jazz is one of those things I can always understand. I personally like, I can say I like jazz. It doesn't mean I like all types of jazz. You know, I mean, I'm very, very picky.
Mm-hmm.
But anytime somebody says that they're not into jazz, I get it. Like, I don't have to question that at all. Like, I can totally understand why. So, all right. So, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I guess I also like how she approaches song making. I think that she's a very deliberate artist. Mm-hmm. I think that she experiments a lot, but I think mm-hmm. she really takes the time to craft an arrangement that works. I think that she's very skilled in doing that, but she also allows for an element of whimsy. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, she has this sort of really delicate and difficult sound, but she really does it very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like that this album doesn't meander back into the pop song territory,
mm-hmm.
you know, unlike 1, 2, 3, 4. And,
right.
It tells me that she's not entirely in it for the money and the fame, because mm-hmm. you know, she was a hot ticket,
yeah,
you know, in the sort of mainstream arena.
Mm-hmm.
But she's really about the art of music and not so much about the you know, I'm gonna play a hit pop song and
right. That's yeah, it. I know. Was it 1, 2, 3, 4 that became like a pretty
yes. I remember it was pretty, played. I mean, I don't listen to mm-hmm. radio.
Right, yeah, I don't. Know.
So I'm not sure how it did in mm-hmm. radio, but I remember every store I walked into, mm-hmm. you know, it was being played on there.
Right, it was like a
constant, you know.
Flavor of the week kind mm-hmm. of thing, so.
And television shows, of course, referenced it, and you know, so mm-hmm. yeah, definitely flavor of the week material. But still quite lovely. I still enjoy it.
Right, right. Yeah, part of you is sort of glad when that happens, because, you know, you're glad that the artist is getting more exposure and everything, but then there's also part of you that's like, no, you're very protective. I feel like I'm that way. Like, no, like, you need to be like a, you know, more of an underground artist. It's like, yeah, I want you to be successful.
Yes,
I want
yeah.
you to be able to make a living.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, I don't want you like filling arenas. No, like that's
yeah, but right.
I get what you're saying there. So, but yeah, was there anything else that you?
No, that's about it.
Okay, yeah, I felt a similar way that you did about the album. Sort of coming into Feist catalog after Metals had come out. I don't really remember exactly how I found out about Feist, aside from I probably heard you playing or something. That's probably what it was. I think you mentioned the name to me one time. I think that's what it was. But so I'm very used to that sound that you were talking about on Metals. You know, that's where it's more of a, there's a lot more rock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pleasure in a lot of ways does feel like a good extension of that sound. But also, in a very interesting way to me, it feels different than Metals, because I feel like Metals was an album where it always felt like she was very much in control of the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Pleasure, I feel like it's a little more like let your hair down.
Mm.
There's times when it sort of rocks like a little bit more, I think. Mm-hmm. There's just less control, I feel like, with feels more organic and spontaneous at times. I also feel like it's more, or I'm sorry, it's actually less abstract lyrically a lot of the time, mm-hmm. than I think Metals was. I think that she was narrowing like the focus a little bit more with a lot of the lyrics on Pleasure. Mm-hmm. Seems more personal in some ways than Metals was. So, but I have to say, I think I prefer Metals.
Mm-hmm.
But this album, after three or four listens to it, it really began to grow on me.
Mm.
So as a whole, I do enjoy it. There's little nitpicking, you know, nitpicky details about it that I can go into. But yeah, that's basically my take on it. So why don't we go through highlights then?
All right.
What was your first one? Because mine is actually the title track. So if
you mean my like most favorite track on this, because I wrote notes for each song.
Oh, nice. No, we can do it like that then. That's fine. Perfect. Perfect. Oh, it's so nice to have someone who takes copious notes like I do. So much better than mental notes. But. All right. Well, then, yeah, let's go right from the top then. So why don't you give me your spin on Pleasure?
Sure. I feel like she's really pondering on sort of what humans do. You know, mm-hmm. we all desire. We all want. We all yearn, and we also have attachments and preferences. Mm-hmm. And just as strongly, we have aversions. And I think that, you know, it's really expressed on this track. I really love the guitar here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's sort of this transition between some kind of dreamy poppiness, mm-hmm. but then there's this gritty guitar, and I really feel like it complements mm-hmm. each other. And of course, her voice is just amazing.
Right.
I love that she uses it as an instrument, and you know, mm-hmm. she's crooning and she's yowling, and she kind of goes between these extremes, but then, like, you know, she's just got just a wonderful, delicate mm-hmm. voice, you know, yeah. but very strong. And I think it gives the song some really great energy.
Yeah. She, her voice is definitely one of the elements of her overall sound that drew me in, you know, that caught my attention right away. As far back as I, you know, can remember when I was first listening to Metals and then checking out, you know, the other other albums in her catalog. I think that this track Pleasure definitely establishes the sound, you know, of this album. Sort of, it sort of sets the tone for it, because it's both subtle and like playful in a way, and like you said, it alternates between the sort of quiet, you know, and then more, you know, a little bit more like jangly rock sort of. And I also like, one of the things that I really like about this album is how there's a lot of, like crowd type vocals on
mm-hmm.
it,
yeah.
which is pretty cool. I don't remember there being much of that, you know, on Metals or,
mm-hmm.
I'd have to, you know, look at the other albums to see about them. But, I feel like that's an element that's particular to this record that also, you know, grabbed me, sort of drew me in, and it gives it a sort of joyous feeling, you know, like a sort of a party atmosphere mm-hmm. to it, which is really cool because it's sort of juxtaposed against the more personal moments, you know, that she's you know, trying to bring out with the lyrics and everything. So yeah, so definitely a great opener. And after that, then it moves into the track "I Wish I Didn't Miss You."
I love this song.
I kind of had a feeling. That you would.
I do, because you know it's very spare in sound, but I think that's what really makes it work. You know, mm-hmm. she's really good at sort of leaving that negative space.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, again, we have those tender, soft vocals and the guitar that are complementing one another. I think this is sort of the confessional song mm-hmm. on the album. And I gotta say, I mean, who hasn't had that lover who, when things ended, you found yourself thinking about, even when you did not want to mm-hmm. be thinking about them?
Right.
mm-hmm. So I, you know, it's a song that I think most people can relate to, and it's also beautifully done.
Yeah, definitely. That's sort of two, you know, universal themes lyrically right in a row there, I think, with Pleasure and then with I Wish I Didn't Miss You. And it's cool because it shows like the dynamic lyrically of the album. Sound wise, it's cool because as spare as it is, you know, she put some sort of odd distortion and delay on the vocals, and there's some ambient effects, you know, going on in the background that to me, like, in theory, like, if I was, I don't know, if I was producing the album or if I was, you know, working with someone and you know, they said, oh, you know, this, here's the idea for this, you know, the sound of this song, I'd be a little skeptical at first. She just does it perfectly. I mean, mm-hmm. it amazes me. I get very jealous of that kind of confidence, you know, that somebody could have. Really reinforces the her particular like personality, I think, that always shines through in the albums, no matter how, you know, commercial, you know, she may have gotten, you know, mm-hmm. at different points. So two pretty solid tracks in a row, and then it and then the record moves into the track Get Not High, Get Not Low. What do you think of that one?
This is probably one of my least favorite songs on the album. I think there are some really interesting things going on in the song. It doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's maybe a tambourine and some maracas in the background. Mm-hmm. The cadence stays the same, and I feel mm-hmm. like it sort of drones on.
Right.
So not mm-hmm. my thing.
I would definitely, it wouldn't be in my, you know, like my top tracks for the record. It's funny because as much as I love Metals, which I've said about 7 times already on this episode, I'm sure I'll say it again. Mm-hmm. There's parts in this song that very much reminded me the sound and the aesthetic of Metals. So it's kind of ironic that I didn't end up, you know, really liking this track all that much. But that just goes to show that I think maybe she was holding on to that sound when, you know, clearly this record was going in a bit different direction. So that could have just been a poor choice on her part. You know, it has some dynamics to it. You know, with like you said, with a lot of the percussion, you know, but I definitely don't see it as a highlight of the album. And mm-hmm. it's kind of funny that it's lyrically it's about mood swings. So just kind of like I said, the highs and the lows, you know. So.
Mm-hmm.
But so from there, yeah, the record moves into the track Lost Dreams.
Well, I found this one slightly more interesting than the last song.
It's good.
But I think it still had the same droning quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes through some of the listens, I found myself enjoying it, but then mm-hmm. on other days I found my interest sort of waned in it. So maybe it's, you know, maybe it's my moods. I don't know.
I get that. I definitely think that it's funny how sometimes different tracks will grab your ear on different days, or sort of, you know, depending on what mood you're in, you know, they might, you know, spark some sort of emotion or like a memory, you know.
Mm.
It's interesting how that works. Yeah, the only thing that I, you know, feel is I don't really find it all that interesting, but I think that it's effective to a degree is some of the sort of like wailing guitars
mm-hmm.
that come in the middle of this track. I feel like they convey, you know, this sort of these feelings of sorrow and regret that she seems to be exploring in the lyrics. So I'm always a big fan of people who can pair, you know, artists that can pair, you know, lyrics, you know, that have a certain theme in them with music that's very appropriate and, you know, where they'll play off each other. We were just talking about Ani DeFranco before. I think she is a master.
Yes.
So it's, yeah, kind of unbelievable. So yeah, I would say, like you said, more interesting than the track before it, but, you know, still kind of if you want to say a lull, you know, mm-hmm. in the album. And then after that, moves into a little bit, I think a little bit more upbeat territory with the track Any Party. So
I think this is probably my favorite song on the album.
Mm-hmm.
Only because again, it's got that guitar sound that I personally love with her voice. And I think that, you know, it's a really interesting song, right? It's a it's a really like sweet declaration of devotion. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure if it's a friend or if it's a lover that she's talking to, because it really could be either.
It's true.
And I think that the, you know, the crowd singing at the end is just like perfect. Right. You know, it really works for the subject matter and for the sound of the song.
Yes, I agree. And it's it's funny. This
is where, like, for a few tracks, the record gets a little weird. Like, in a way. not in a bad way. I don't mean this as a... It's not a negative thing. It's just it starts to do some kind of funny things that, you know, if you're really paying attention when you listen to it, you'll notice. But if it's kind of, like, on in the background, you might not pick it up at first. But, but I just... I love how at the end of the track... You know, there's the recording of, you can hear like somebody, you know, leaving the party. Yeah. You just had the crowd vocals and you hear somebody, you know, walk out the door and they're walking down to, you know, what I would guess is, you know, their car. And you hear some dogs barking. I think there's like a train whistle. And then you actually hear a car drive by and it's, the stereo is playing the first track from the album, Pleasure. So you hear it for a second. So it's this interesting sort of like fourth wall moment. So I thought that was pretty cool. It like I was listening to it too, I was paying close attention, so I did catch it the first time. But I could see myself totally missing that.
Oh, I missed it the first time.
Did you miss it? Yeah.
I totally missed it the first time. And then the next time I was like, oh, what?
Because when I heard that sound of like the car driving by and I heard there was music, I was like, I have to, like, what is that song that's playing? So then it was just kind of an added, you know, haha, you know, it was the first track from the album. I thought that was cool. This is definitely one of my favorites too. If not my top track, like you said, with the crowd vocals, you know, it works. And it's kind of the best to me. It's like the best, has the best dynamics, I think, any other tracks on the album. You know, there is that, folk quality to it, but there is the, you know, her very unique vocals. That I don't like to, the only term I can use, and I don't know if it's really the best term to use, but I put madcap. Like sometimes they're almost like madcap for vocals a little bit. It's only because I can't think of a better description of it. They're kind of but in such a good way. So from any party, then it moves into the track "A Man Is Not His Song."
I kind of puzzle over this one. So lyrically, I think that, you know, she's suggesting that it doesn't work to idealize or romanticize another person, you know, and that also it could also be read as the, you know, a person is not necessarily their art. You know, a lot of people declare themselves as their art is themselves, and, you know, et cetera. But when you, the viewer or the listener or what have you, are relating to that piece of art and then you're thinking about the person behind it, you don't necessarily view that art the same way that the creator created that art for.
Right.
Right? So "A Man Is Not a Song"? Yeah. Okay. I get that part. Am I in love with this song? No. No, I'm not
either. Yeah, I was reading online about how, I don't know if you knew this, but back in I think it was like 2000, I want to say it's like 2007 or 2008, I think it might have even been later than that, but basically like after the band Mastodon, after they released this album that was called The Hunter, they Mastodon and Feist did this thing, because I guess they're, you know, they've been friendly for a long time. They did this, it was basically like a single for like the record store day of that year, where they covered Feist covered a Mastodon song and then Mastodon covered a Feist song. Feist did a song of theirs called Black Tongue, and then Mastodon did a cover of that song, A Commotion, from Metals, which was pretty cool. So I was reading that the reason that she used the sample that comes in at the end of this track, because it's a sample of a Mastodon song called High Road, she thought, she kind of figured that it it goes along with the theme that you were mentioning about how, you know, a person is not necessarily their art. And she's always felt that Mastodon, the sound of Mastodon, is very masculine.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you'll lose sight of the people, like the, mm-hmm. the complex, you know, individuals that are behind that sound sometimes, because it's just so, you know,
yes,
yeah. very masculine, very, all I can think of is masculine, but anyway, we'll edit that part. So that's why she did that. But to be honest, I didn't like the inclusion of the sample.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it didn't fit. I thought it was just kind of like...
That makes more sense. I did not realize it was a sample from a Mastodon song, yeah. but now that you're telling me this, I'm like, oh, that's what that is.
Right. I honestly thought when I first listened to the album that my iPod was... or my iPhone was like fritzing, like it was just like something was wrong with it,
mm-hmm.
because I have some Mastodon on my so I'm like what is going on? But then I all of a sudden made the connection. I'm like, oh, that's right, they did that covers thing where they, you know, so then it sort of made sense, especially like when I read about the, you know, the lyrical themes there. But I don't know, you know, I'm sure a lot of people, I mean, you didn't realize that they did that, you know, the where they covered each other's songs, so a lot of people are probably just like, why is that on there?
Yeah,
they don't really get. And if you don't, you know, take the time to go and see like what's going on there, then you're just gonna be like, this is just this weird outro, you know, outro to this
yes.
song. Like,
uh-huh.
So I think that could have probably been left off the record, and I wouldn't have missed it at all, even as a big Mastodon fan. So, and then, so after that track abruptly ends. Another thing about this album,
I know.
A lot of the tracks end so abruptly, like it kind of aggravates me, because I'm a big fan of, you know, albums that, you know, where the tracks either bleed into each other,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, at least there's not this like where you feel like tracks are getting cut off.
Yeah.
And she does that a few times on this record, and it mm-hmm. kind of rankles
me. Yeah, I prefer feeling like the endings are resolved.
Right.
Like it's a resolved ending.
Right.
Rather than just, oh, we're going to end it here.
Yeah, I remember there was a typo negative album where they did that.
Yes,
the October Rust. Then
yes, yep. Uh-huh.
They kept doing that, and it was like,
oh, yep. Let me tell you, as a DJ, that is your nightmare. Right. You have to sit there and watch the seconds count down, right. and you're like, okay, and now.
Yeah, I can see how that would. Yeah, that would be a real pain in the butt. So. But yeah. So, you know, from the extremely frustrating end of a man in that song, we move, especially for DJs, any of you out there, we move into the track The Wind.
All right, so this is a track that sort of won me over, even though I feel it's a slightly jazzy number. I think it has a very delicate rhythm. And I think what really won me over on this was the lyrics, though. I feel like on some of the other tracks, her lyrics are very simplistic,
mm-hmm.
Because I think that she's more into using her voice as one of the instruments rather than sort of writing lyrics first and then, you know, adding music later,
mm-hmm.
Where the lyrics are sort of highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I think she plays some really beautiful poetry over guitars and horn and keyboards, and I think it all plays really well together.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just read part of the lyrics?
Absolutely.
Great. It brings hail from old water and a storm on its knees, and flags from a revolution that brought us some peace. And the trees for their 100 years lean north like calligraphy, and I'm shaped by my storming like they're shaped by their storming. And I just think it's beautiful, right?
It is. I was listening to that track on the way over here to record this segment, and those lines always jump out at me too.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely catch your ear. She's capable of this kind of poetry, you know, and
mm-hmm.
it's beautiful. So sometimes, you know, when it's kind of, you know, sparse throughout the album, you know, it makes me kind of wish a little bit more, you know, if there was some more of that kind of poetry in there. But, you know, if that were the case, then, you know, it might feel overhanded, you know, sort of mm-hmm. ham-fisted, if you will, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I get, you know, I like the fact that it's definitely balanced between very, very personal, very specific, you know, emotions and situations. And then you can have these more, you know, abstract sort of poetic passages. And she's good enough that she could use storming twice there at the end.
Yeah, don't right? Even think yes. about it.
I'm always like, damn it, when people can do that. And I'm like most people would tell you, don't do that. Like right. when you're writing poetry or you're writing, right. you know.
It's like she knows the rules well enough to break it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Love it.
But, yeah. I found this track to be very, very odd the first couple of times I listened to it. And at first, I really didn't think that the there's little electronic elements in it. You know, I didn't think they added anything to the song really.
Mm.
And I'm not sure if they do still. But as the song grew on me, it kind of. You know, I'm just sort of like indifferent to those elements of the song. I mean, I think if it was just mm-hmm. you know, just her with a guitar, you know, very spare.
And even with the horn, I wouldn't have mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. The horn is kind of nice.
Right. So it's just kind of I think this could have worked without some of those little touches that are in there. But they don't bother me. It's just kind of sometimes you know, you listen to these songs and these things. You know, happen in the background, and you're kind of like, why did you do that? Like, that's weird. Which, when we get to the next track, I'm definitely going to talk about. So, did you have anything else to say about The Wind?
No.
I feel like I sort of, okay.
Yep.
All right, so, from The Wind, we move into the track Century, which features a man by the name of Jarvis Cocker, who is Joe Cocker's son.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's literally the only thing I know him for.
Right. Me too. Which is upsetting because when I first saw like the track listing for the album before I had ever listened to it, and I said, oh look, Joe Cocker, because I had heard the name before, I knew it was his son, and I said, oh look, Joe Cocker's on this track, like that's kind of cool, you know, maybe it'll be like a male female like dynamic going on there in the track. And no that's not what happened at all. I think the track Century is great up until, you know, the part where it breaks into Jarvis Cocker's like spoken word
yes.
part, where he's talking about how many days and seconds and hours there are in a century, in this very sort of deep like voice that I felt like was like you were watching a fantasy movie or something.
Yeah.
It was like a over the narrator or whatever. And so yeah, I just think it's so good. If you just cut that part off of it, and then he should have sang like backup or something. I don't understand, but musically, it's really cool. It's a very like rough sounding track to me. Like it has that rock, you know, edge. I think that that Pleasure does, and you know, sort of, which is cool because you know, this late in the album to bring that sound back, you know. It gives it a good sort of like symmetry, I think. But like I said, the end was just completely unnecessary to me. So,
I could tell you feel really strongly about this.
Especially since I didn't ask you your take on it first, and I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. No, it's totally fine. So.
But anyway, what did you think?
I love that the heavy guitar riffs are back.
Mm-hmm.
I really love to hear Feist rocking out
yes.
in the way that she rocks out.
Mm-hmm.
But I totally agree. The spoken word by Jarvis Cocker was totally unexpected the first time I listened. I was just like, what, where did this come from?
Right.
And it really felt disjointed, you know? You know, in subsequent listenings, it grew on me.
Okay.
And I found that it kind of added and not detracted from the song.
Okay.
Saying that, if she were to go back and cut that part out, I would not miss it.
Okay. Yeah, that's really how I feel too. Like if you know, when I was past couple times I've listened to the album, I don't skip over it. I mean, it doesn't bother me that much, you know, where I feel like I need to go past it. You know, I'll let the track play, but it's just kind of another strange choice to me. The first time I listened to the track, I kept waiting to hear, you know, somebody else's voice come in, and you know, I was getting to where there was, you know, like whatever, a minute and a half or whatever left of the track, 2 minutes. I'm like, well, that's odd. I haven't heard anybody that sounds like, you know, Joe Cocker, because I didn't, you know what Jarvis Cocker sounded like. And so then when this thing came in at the end, I was like, I don't know about that. Not feeling it. But like you said, it grew on you, you know, so it's, you know, there's people that could absolutely feel that part of the track is essential, you know, people that listen to it. So It's just a matter of opinion, I guess. To me, she could have chopped it. If there was a single version of this song where they just chopped that off, like, I would probably download it and throw it in the mix. There you go. Sorry, Jarvis Cocker. No offense to you.
I know. No, you know.
But next time, yeah, sing. Sing on the Vice Chapter. Maybe he wanted to, too. Maybe he was like, what the hell? Like, why are you? But anyway. So after Century, then it moves into the track Baby Be Simple. So what did you think of that one?
I think that it was lovely. You know, it's soft, it's gentle. She's imploring her beloved to be honest and to be authentic. I think to show her something real and to allow themselves to be vulnerable, which I think, of course, you know, it can be difficult. And I think that the musicality of the song really matches these lyrics, right? It's very melodious. It's very lovely. And I think it even is a little haunting, which I think totally matches sort of our moods about allowing ourselves to be vulnerable.
Right. Yeah, I was getting that, you know, that lyrical theme too. You know, like you said, being vulnerable of, you know, trying to not be complicated, you know, trying to just, you know, love someone without all the, you know, all the sort of complexity and the distractions and the complexities and everything. Her voice really carries the song, like, on this one, especially because you go from Century, which is very upbeat, very rocking, very there's a lot going on musically, and then this is a little bit more spare, you know. And so yeah, her voice is definitely the thing that stood out to me. Even though there's not like a lot of flair really as far as the vocals, you know, she plays a little more straight, I think, on this one. But I mean, she's just, her vocals are just that good, you know. I also think it's funny too that it goes from the last three tracks, which were sort of, there was a lot going on, like I said, a lot of weird stuff happening, like, and then it goes into this track, which you have to wonder if like she did that on purpose.
Yeah.
Like, now there's this track that's about being, you know, simple and not complicated. And so I thought that was kind of interesting, like a sort of, you know, maybe people catch that, maybe they won't moment. Yeah. So I think the first time I listened to the record, it sort of, it felt a little bit like, she put the brakes on too fast after Century. That feeling has sort of gone away, you know, listening to the album more and more now that I have up like a picture of the album as a whole in my mind. But yeah, definitely, like, on first listen, it felt a little bit too jarring, like she kind of she stopped things a little too quickly. But and then we move into the track I'm Not Running Away.
So the opening guitar on this, I think, is very sort of twangy. And when I listen to this track, feel like I've been transported to sort of a dive bar where the jukebox only plays classic rock and country.
That is a very good way to put it.
So not saying that I didn't like it. It had that feeling, you know, I just felt like, okay, this is kind of an interesting place to be on this album, you know?
It felt like, to go along with, you know, you were saying that, you know, you feel like you're, you know, in a dive bar with the jukebox that's playing all, you know, the classic rock and country and stuff. Like, I kept thinking of Tom Petty when I listened to this song. It was weird. Like, it just, like...
That totally works.
Yeah, like, that vibe came across. Like, it doesn't even necessarily sound that much like Tom Petty. It's just, that's the vibe that came across to me. Because it is, you know, a lot of it is just sort of straightforward, you know, bluesy kind of folk rock. It doesn't mess around too much. I mean, you know, there's a couple like little interesting vocal, you know, flourishes there, you know, in the track or whatever. But yeah, besides that, it is pretty, she plays it pretty straight on that one. So we move from that track into the closing track, which is called Young Up, which I feel like is such an awkward title. I don't know why. It's just like weird to me. But anyway, what'd you think?
Young Up, I think that it's a song that sort of brings up a significant topic for many adults, you know, because I think that we get stuck in our routines, we sort of get stuck in our ways, you know, at what point do we sort of look at ourselves and say, have we become drones? Right. Are our lives monotonous? Are we challenging ourselves and growing in new ways? And so I really like the reminder to sort of young up. I think the music is a little slow, but it's more of a middle of the road song for me on this album.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's my take on it.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things that bothers me a lot, because I'm such a, more so than when I was younger, like I'm much more of an album oriented person now. Like I was saying before, I like albums where the tracks sort of bleed into each other, or I pay a lot of attention to how albums are sequenced, you know, as far as the tracks now. I feel like this track and I'm Not Running Away that came before it almost belong, like they almost belong more in the middle of the record to me. I felt like it was a little disjointed, because it doesn't feel like climactic or anything.
Mm-hmm.
To me. It's kind of like, you know, there was this rising action, you know, that sort of culminates in Century, and then Baby Be Simple is kind of like the falling action. Like if you're thinking about a movie, like a film, then
mm-hmm.
you know, Baby Be Simple is the falling action, and after the sort of resolution of the story. So like I said, I'm Not Running Away and Young Up, they don't feel like tracks that should be on the end of an album. To me, they feel like tracks that should be in the middle. All right, so that sums up the tracks that are on Pleasure. So Veronica, I always invite guests to give a rating of the album if they'd like to. So what do you think you would rate Pleasure?
I think I would rate this one a 7 out of 10.
Yeah, I actually, we're pretty close then, because I gave it a 6.5 out of 10. It's a good album. I think that, you know, Feist is continuing to go down a path that, you know, she's really carving out sort of her own niche, you know, that she started, you know, with, I really think she started with Metals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I like it as much as Metals, but there's definitely a bias there, because anytime I discover an artist sort of mid-career, you know, it's that album. It's like whatever album I listen to first, I tend to have a very, you know, emotional connection to, and I just did. So it's kind of hard. So it didn't quite live up to Metals, but it is a different sort of record, like we said. It's
mm-hmm.
I shouldn't really, you know, put it side by side with Metals, because she is trying to accomplish something different with it. But yeah, I think it's one of those albums where you know, she's experimenting, and perhaps I have a feeling that perhaps maybe on her next record, maybe she'll be on a little bit more sure footing.
I feel the same way. I feel like this is a transitional album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I look at it too. And a lot of times those kind of albums are my favorite albums, because I enjoy I enjoy that sort of, you know, that musical evolution, that movement. You know, even if the songs aren't, you know, all, you know, 10 out of 10, you know, like I still like seeing and hearing that movement. So yeah, so like I said, 6.5 out of 10, a 7 out of 10 from Veronica here. So definitely, for anybody listening, definitely check out this album. If you don't know Feist, I don't know. I almost think Metals is almost better.
I would agree.
To start with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, obviously people can do what they want. So I'd say either Metals or this record, I think, you know, check them out, because they're definitely her most, they're the two albums, I believe, where, you know, she really goes after like a certain sound, and, you know, it's a little less commercial, like we were talking about earlier. So, all right. Well, that wraps up today's main event. Veronica, thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. This was fun.
Yeah, no problem. It had been a long time since we talked, so this was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And and also to all the listeners, thank you for listening, and we will catch you later. Thanks.
All right, that concludes episode 6 of Radio Live Transmission. That episode was entitled A Pleasurable Discourse. Make sure you check back in all throughout the month of July. I'm going to be releasing a segment every week of various types and lengths. So make sure you guys check back in for that. And thank you for listening. And I'll catch you soon. All right. Bye-bye.